Held captive as a prisoner of war, Picard must endure the cruelest punishment imaginable.
You cannot just abandon him. He's gone.
Will torture leave him a forgotten casualty of war?
I can't believe you're willing to sacrifice Captain Picard's life as a negotiation tactic.
Are you questioning my judgment, Commander?
Or can he survive the most brutal test of courage in his life?
You cannot hurt me!
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And this week we have a special guest, the man who keeps trying to make us say there are five lights, Jamie Davies.
Hello.
Guys... go ahead, Mr. Davies.
No, I was just going to say, back by unpopular demands, I think this is like maybe my fourth appearance on the show.
And nobody's asked for you to come back.
No.
Not even us. You just kind of showed up tonight. And
yeah,
like, oh,
I was just seeing what you guys are up to tonight. And yeah, I just thought I'd just stay.
We were hiding behind the window like, don't look up.
No, that's the problem. Like Jamie, like listeners, no joke, Jamie literally lives half a block away. He saw the light was on in my apartment. So he just showed up and I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, it's podcast night. Cam, what are we talking about this evening other than making fun of Jamie?
So this is another two-parter throwback. This time, Chain of Command, the Season 6 two-parter, where Picard gets strapped up, stripped down, and has to stare at some lights.
There you go. Well, Jamie's actually on our very first two-parter in which we dissected the Menagerie. Jamie, one of your favorite episodes, was it not?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the part of the Menagerie when the crew... We were watching the crew watch TV. That was really exciting.
You mean the entire Menagerie?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. This is one of the most acclaimed episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation. I think Patrick Stewart, David Warner, just the recognition that they have for their performances here, quite amazing. But Jamie, coming at it as more of an outsider, I mean, you are kind of a casual fan of Next Generation. You watched it a little bit growing up, but I mean, what are your thoughts? Did you ever see this episode before this evening?
I've never seen it. Like, back in the day, yeah, I used to watch Next Gen quite a lot as a child. But yeah, I've never seen this episode, so yeah, it was cool to check out.
Well, I'm curious, Cam, did you see this for the very first time just a few years ago when you were doing kind of the big Next Gen run-through, or had you caught this before just as a more casual Next Gen
fan? No, I never saw this one when I was young, and we see the odd episode in syndication. I watched this one about, I guess, a year and a half ago.
What were your just kind of, just some initial thoughts watching it a year and a half ago? Did it live up to, I guess, some of the acclaim that had been presented to you from the community?
I knew nothing about the acclaim.
Oh, really?
Before I watched it. No,
interesting.
No,
so you weren't really expecting, like, an episode that I think is pretty standout.
No, I really wasn't, and we've talked about the other two-parters leading up to this one so far, Unification, Redemption, etc. I gotta say, when I was watching Season 6, which I very much enjoyed, I think it's a really strong season, I wasn't looking forward to another two-parter.
Yeah.
When I saw Chain of Command Part 1 and 2 on the DVD menu, I was like, oh, another hour and a half, you know, our 45-minute episode stretched to an hour and a half, and I was blown away, and I really loved it a lot. I thought it was fantastic.
I believe this is, you know, one of those episodes that I did actually see in first run when I was a kid. And even as a kid, I was just... Here's the thing. It's a bit of a slow-moving episode. It's not super action-packed, even though there's some cool sequences in it.
Hello. There's rappelling.
Yeah. and a lot of spelunking. but even as a kid, I could appreciate just kind of the gravitas that, Patrick Stewart and David Warner brought to this two-parter. But I think as a kid, I probably like part one a little bit because it's more action-packed, but I could appreciate just how cool it was. Just part two, just what an amazing outing this was for the Next-Gen crew. But Jamie, I'm curious. We're in 2016, flash forward. I think this episode aired, almost 25 years ago, back in 1992, I believe.
Yeah.
Does this hold up to you as a remnant of the early 90s television? Do you think this is a solid episode, or were you hitting the snooze button similar to the Menagerie when you watched that a few months ago?
I thought it was a good episode. Like, first part, yeah, it's a little bit slow. But yeah, I think it really holds up. Like, I asked Cam when we had a break, like, when was this made? And yeah, like, 92, 93. Yeah, it holds up really well. I mean, there are parts where it's a little bit dumb, like the rocks and stuff like that.
The styrofoam rocks.
So, yeah, some of the, like, that set looks a bit dumb, but, I really enjoyed this episode. I was kind of, it's harder to think of things to say, like, when you actually enjoy it. Like, I was...
Well, it's easier for you to kind of, like, make fun of the Menagerie.
Yeah, exactly.
I think you're just kind of like, oh, man, we're watching people watch TV for, you know, an hour and a half. But in this case, I mentioned it to you guys, for a long time, I just kind of had way more notes going for part one than I did for part two, because I was just sitting in awe of Patrick Stewart's performance. Mm-hmm. But Cam, I'm curious for you, what was your reaction? Did you have a different reaction this second time around than you did the first time you saw it, or how have your feelings about this particular episode developed?
Rewatching it was interesting because my memories of the episode were different than the reality. Mm. And that I recalled it being a two-parter of Picard and Madred.
I have a very similar thought process. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Okay. Whereas, you know, Madred, as we know, doesn't really appear till the very, very end of part one.
Yeah.
It was interesting rewatching it with the, you know, the full episode worth of lead up. I didn't expect that, but I honestly found the first half equally as exciting. I love Captain Jellicoe. I think Captain Jellicoe is amazing.
Well, this is a question that I want to pose to you guys, and we can talk about it throughout the episode, but is Captain Jellicoe a good commanding officer?
Yeah, let's get back to that one in a bit, yeah. Because I think that's a very good question. But I really loved part one, and again, part two was absolutely masterful. I think this is one of the greatest two-parters. I think this is so far from the... We've been going through them chronologically. This is my favorite two-parter so far in TNG.
I really know it's sacrilege in the Star Trek community to not say best of both worlds. The Borg two-parter is the best two-parter ever produced. Here's the thing. Part one is outstanding. Part two is notably weaker. This is an instance where I think we get like a really strong part one and an even stronger part two. I really think this is the best two-parter to date that Star Trek The Next Generation has ever produced. And again,
I mean, at least until we cover Birthright next month.
I'm so looking forward to watching Worf stare at a half Romulan, half Klingon getting out of a lake in the Buff. Anyway.
I have no memory of that. Wow, no, I'm looking forward to that episode.
Oh, dear. Guys, you can't see it, but, like, I'm just pulling my collar back and, you know.
Is it getting hot in here?
Ooh. But, I've not seen this one. I think I watched it as part of, like, a marathon on, like, the Space Channel, which is, like, the Canadian version of the Sci-Fi Channel.
Do you have fans in America?
Oh, yeah, we do. We probably have, I would say we have more fans in the U.S.
I don't think we have any fans in Canada.
No, we do have a guy over at the University of BC. Maybe not anymore after Jamie was so disparaging towards the Menagerie. But, we do have a couple local listeners.
Yes, that's right.
But
your mom and dad doesn't count.
Okay? What about my sister? Sad little anecdote here. My girlfriend's never listened to one single episode. So I'm not getting those downloads here. Cam's like, a real doll isn't a girlfriend. Anyway.
Moving on.
Watching it now, I appreciate this so much more than I did as a kid. And there's just so much going on throughout this episode that just layers upon layers that I didn't pick up as a kid. I think this is an amazing episode, and I think it's the best two-parter that we've watched so far in our endeavor here, Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just get into it. Like, what works for you guys? I mean, Jamie, I know it's a little tough that you don't have as much to say about it because you can't make fun of it so much, but I mean, what stands out to you? What works for you when you're watching this episode? Like, was there any particular story points, character moments, performances that you're like, oh, wow, this is, you know, on fire?
Yeah, I mean, the part two stood out to me, and mm-hmm. the the main reason that stood out to me was the interaction between Picard and the other guy.
Gollum Dread?
Yeah, that one.
Or Golemek?
Yes.
Or Captain Jellico? Or I'm trying to think of like other like random characters you can't remember.
The guy who's got like a thumbprint in the middle of his forehead.
Do you know what actually the derogatory term for a Cardassian is in the Star Trek universe, Jamie?
No.
They call them spoonheads.
Spoonheads, okay.
Yeah, so there you go.
Captain Spoonhead and Picard then. yeah, that was kind of like my favorite part. Like and like seeing whether he would like break and yeah, that was really like it was really tense. So that worked for me really well. And then Captain Jellico and Beardy, we'll call him.
Riker.
That's it, Riker. Sure. Yeah, I mean, that like their relationship and their conflict was actually like really interesting. So I think like
you really dug all that shift rotation talk that they're having in 10-4?
Yeah, I mean, like some of it kind of like
I will defend the shift.
I like that scene, but I was like, I've never heard so much talk about shift rotations in Star Trek in my life.
I think it's really interesting the way that this episode pairs Riker against Jellico and Picard against Madred, and there's parallels between both of them. One is arguing 3 versus 4 shifts, and the other is arguing 4 versus 5 lights. They both got children.
Yeah,
there's some interesting looks at basically people who are in power who maybe don't command the respect or of the person opposite them.
Right here in my notes, I'll go to you in just a moment, but like right
teacher.
Right here in my notes, I put a little star next to it, and it just says spiritual battle, : Picard versus Madred, Riker versus Jellico. Yeah. So Cam, I think we're totally on the same page here. Why don't we dive into kind of your thoughts about this? Because I agree, and this is something that I didn't pick up on as a kid watching it for the first time, 25 years ago, and then again, maybe like 10 or 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. But I mean, tell me about why you think this is kind of a great parallel between these four respective characters that we mentioned here.
Well, it's interesting. Well, so I guess we'll start with Picard and Madred, because in many ways they are very similar.
Saving the best for last.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
In my mind, yes, I am. To me, like the two characters are very similar. They're intensely intellectual. They are not physical men, although we do see Picard rappelling and spelunking, and as you said in this episode.
Neither one of them are British by birth, but they both have English accents.
That's right, yes. David Warner, when he was hired, I mean, he's a Shakespearean actor. They knew what they were doing. They knew they wanted a actor who was in the same sort of ballpark as Patrick Stewart.
They saw him in Star Trek V and were like, we need to get that cat in the room with Picard.
Yes. Anyway. And they're also both very unflashy. Picard is not a Kirk. He's not walking in there with flair and verve and whatever, swagger and whatever other terms I can come up with. He comes in very matter-of-fact and intellectual, and that is what Gal Madred is. He's very... I mean, this episode is very much about sort of how mundane evil can be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's tormenting Picard this entire episode, and it's like a day at the office. This is like paperwork for him.
Do you even think, you guys, that Madred is kind of petty?
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting to me that we rarely get, like, layered villains or antagonists. They're very often just kind of one note.
Mm-hmm.
It's so fascinating to see such a guy. He's got this family, he's got this backstory, whether he's growing up with his Bowery Boys gang that he was alluding to. But he could be just so utterly petty, and Picard calls him on it.
Mm-hmm.
That gets under his skin, which is amazing.
That's
to
ultimately
see.
The victory of the episode. Yeah. Like, this is an episode where they blow up, the enemy ship. It's like him getting Madred to break.
Do you think we would ever get an episode like this on Voyager, where I think ultimately the goal is to blow up the alien ship?
No.
I think it would be tough, for the writers on Voyager to produce kind of the equivalent. I could understand, the Deep Space Nine writers doing a very similar episode, but I don't know. It's just such a very different kind of episode than we would get on a more action-oriented show like Voyager.
Not to drift too far off course between paralleling these sets of characters. I was just curious, do you think this episode would have happened while Gene Roddenberry was alive and in control?
No. Number one reason why, and I think one of the reasons why this episode stands out, is kind of all the interpersonal conflict going on between Jellico and the rest of the Enterprise crew.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Gene Roddenberry would have ever had it. Jamie, I mean, Gene Roddenberry did not want any, like, internal conflict going on within the ship's
crew members. I heard about that, right? So the first seasons...
Yeah, two seasons, yeah.
Yeah, that's, like, very much... There's no conflict. Whereas, like, Captain Kirk and Spock, they do have conflicts. And they're, like, they're really at each other at some points. But
which is so why that series was so great.
So then I was kind of, like, surprised to see, oh, wow, there's actually arguments in this episode. Because I thought that wasn't the case, right? In Next Gen. That's how I remember it anyway. Yeah. So, yeah. I did notice that.
And it works because, I don't know, I don't know, you brought up Mandredin versus Picard. Can we talk about Jellicoe for just a bit?
For sure, yeah.
I think this guy is just such a fascinating antithesis to Picard, because that's another parallel there.
Yeah.
Picard is a very aloof commander, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Jellicoe is the micromanager. I've never seen a micromanager like this on Star Trek before.
And he's, I like that he's almost like a bland kind of corporate dude.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing memorable about Ronnie Cox.
He's just, he looks like you kind of picked him out of a pool of an accountants and put him in charge of a Galaxy class starship.
He's a Walmart manager, is what he is. Yeah. I mean, like, this guy just screams unexceptional just to look at him. He's schlumpy. I love that when the episode, the second part is, you know, at the end and he leaves, it's the most schlumpy walk off set ever. And I feel like it was all intentional.
What I mean, maybe let's kind of address this question that I posed earlier. Do you think Captain Jellicoe is a good commander? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, Jamie, I want to get your opinion. He was kind of posed as the antagonist to much of the Enterprise crew. I think Data pretty much dug him. But other than that, he was kind of an antagonist. But do you think he's an actual good Starfleet commander?
Yeah, like Cam said, he's a micromanager. So no. In some respects, no. He was, like, quite tough in, like, other instances, and I was like, yeah, okay, I respect that. When he was, like, saying, no, we're not going to rescue Picard, I was like, okay, I respect your decision, but hang on, it's only been an hour, and you're saying he's dead. Yeah. Like, come on, man. Like, I respect your decision.
Have some humanity.
Yeah, I mean, like, you haven't heard from him in, like, half an hour. Like, why are you considering him dead? Yeah. But I liked his stance in saying, no, we're not going after him.
He had his mind on the mission a lot. Cam, what are your thoughts? Because, I mean, I think people could come down on either side about, oh, I hate Jellicoe, or, you know what, he actually has a point.
Well, here's my thing about Jellicoe. Jellicoe, to me, reminds me very much of, you know, sort of the real world when, say, like, yeah, I've encountered this in my job, where the workplace kind of gets audited and they send someone from head office to investigate. The person, Jellicoe was like that head office guy who was the fixer. He's going to come in, he's going to look at your numbers, he's going to figure out the problem. He's not going to be that nice about it. He's going to solve the problem, and he's going to leave.
So he's like the wolf from Pulp Fiction.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he's Harvey Keitel. Yeah. So, like, there, Jellicoe, I mean, if Jellicoe were your permanent captain...
Jellicoe wishes he was Harvey Keitel.
Jellicoe would never be a permanent captain. He would be someone you would send in, I feel like, in a crisis... Yeah, yeah. Who's gonna whip, you know, the crew kind of into shape and get the hell out. Like, he is not the guy who's gonna be going on exploratory missions of, you know, the Alpha Quadrant.
Do you think this is the best 5 days the crew of the USS Cairo ever had?
It's their vacation?
Yeah. they must have just been breathing a sigh of relief, you know, loosening their belts a little bit when Jellicoe was gone.
Was that their ship that was being towed from the side?
Yeah, the Excelsior class starship, yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And his crew was on there?
Yeah.
Oh, they must have been just, like, fucking partying.
Oh, right? Yeah.
They're all in the holodecks.
They're like, I don't need to coordinate the warp coils. Sorry, man.
They went from 4 duty ships to 3.
But here's the fascinating thing is, you know, I love all of the back and forth between him and Goldamek in the observation lounge. And... You know, Riker remarks to Troy, well, that guy is surely certain of himself. And Troy's like, no, he's not. I think this is an insecure dude. And I think that's what's fascinating is seeing somebody who's essentially insecure deep down running a starship. Would you categorize any of the other, you know, prominent Starfleet captains as insecure? I think the closest we get is maybe Kirk. I think Kirk has some insecurities.
Yeah.
But everyone else...
Well, we got Alan Ruck in Star Trek Generations.
Well, I'm thinking about, like, the big five, you know? I don't know. I think this could be perhaps the most insecure on the inside, but like most assertive on the outside Starfleet captain we've ever encountered in this particular
instance. Is that the character's strength, though, that he is so insecure? Like, he is the man who can get this job done because he's more willing to kind of fight dirty.
Do you think it's a bit of an overcompensation on his part? Yeah.
Is he a reoccurring character? Because he's quite interesting.
No.
Like, he is interesting. Whether you like him or not, like, he's a good character.
And every scene he has with the TNG crew is like fireworks going on.
Oh, yeah.
It's fascinating to watch Geordi get angry at him and Riker fight with him.
Well, even Troy is like, hey, I think we have some morale problems. Jellicoe's, I don't have time for this. You take care of it. You obviously thought about it a lot. Just the stunned look on her face. Yes. And what do you guys think about him making her get into an actual professional Starfleet uniform?
Yeah, good for him.
Yeah.
Like, she's coming in with casual clothes.
Yeah.
Like, where's she going to the gym? Like,
well, it leads you then to go, like, wait, why was she wearing this uniform in the first place?
Yeah, it always made me wonder, because she started off in a Starfleet uniform in, like, season one and two, and then, or I guess season one, and then she drifted into, like, her gym clothes.
Like, was Picard just letting it get lax on the bridge?
I think maybe Roddenberry is making it lax on the bridge, personally. But I don't know. Here's the thing. You asked if he was a recurring character. I think there's so much potential for them to bring him back.
I was going to say a Jellicoe show.
Maybe that's what Brian Fuller is working on right now, starring Ronnie Cox.
How old is Ronnie Cox now?
He must be, what, 80-something? Yeah. He's up there. Mind you, he has... how old do you think this guy's kid is, Jellicoe's kid, who's drawing elephants?
Well, they're both older men with young children.
Yeah.
Like, the comparisons are really interesting.
You're talking about Goldman Dredd.
Yes.
Yeah. But just one thing, Jamie, you asked if he's a recurring character. Do you know which character, out of everyone we're introduced to here, becomes a recurring character on Star Trek The Next Generation? It's not Jellicoe.
From this episode?
From this episode.
One of the guys in the... not interrogation room, but when they're meeting, when they're negotiating.
Golamek. Here's the thing. I thought Golamek was a great character. I'm shocked that they never brought him back, though.
Oh, wait. Is it Big Ears?
The Ferengi character?
The Ferengi? No. Damon Salok, I think. No.
In the world's smallest bar.
I actually wrote, like, sad Mos Eisley Cantina in my notes here.
Oh, it's beyond sad. We've seen the sad one in Star Trek 3. This is, like, tragic.
Even the one that we saw in Unification had so much more going for it. I'm talking about, like, the opera singer with four hands.
Right.
Banging on the organ and singing with Worf. Jamie, you missed a great, great musical performance there.
No, you didn't. You didn't.
But it's actually the Admiral Inchaev, who apparently doesn't really feel like wearing a comm badge for half the episode.
I didn't catch that.
Okay. It's very weird, but...
Is he a spoonhead?
No, she is the female Admiral who is giving Jellicoe the orders and relieved Picard. Yeah. That was the first time we ever were introduced to her.
She's hardly in it at all.
Yeah, she doesn't come around in part two. She's just there for part one. But they keep bringing her back. I think Inchaev, like, was a great admiral, like, a kind of a bit of a sparring partner for Picard as she developed through the series. They brought her back for Deep Space Nine as well. I would have much rather... we just did our Admirals episode last week, guys. I'd have much rather had her around for Deep Space Nine than, say, Admiral Ross.
Right. And then you know that they knew they had a good character because Riker reacts to her in a way... that he would never react to any other admiral on that show.
Well, as in, he has a reaction.
Yes, exactly.
I know, he just needs to give her some canapes, and we know from Journey's End that's her weak spot there.
That is a thing. Yeah. So let's get back to Riker and Jellicoe.
No, I want to make this a Inchaev episode, sorry.
About these two, because... whereas, like, Picard's is more of this battle sort of between justice and injustice, or good and evil, however you want to present it. Though the one with Riker and Jellicoe is different, because there's more gray involved in this debate. Because, to me, a lot of it has to do with ego for both men.
Oh, you know what? Here's the thing. If Riker was my first officer, and he wasn't carrying out my commands, if he was questioning me a lot... I think there's a difference between, like, giving sage advice and then just, like, questioning the orders of your captain. I don't really blame Jellicoe for having the reaction that he did to Riker, even for relieving him of duty. And it's interesting, you're supposed to be put off by Jellicoe's behavior, but just by design of the writers, but I think he has a point here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, I mean, someone like Riker, who's such a strong personality, requires a very strong captain.
Yes.
And Jellicoe is not the man to have a character like Riker. I mean, there's a reason Data's his go-to second in command.
That's true. Well, what if this was like a the episode that introduced us to Admiral Pressman? Do you think, like, how would he have handled this Riker fella?
Oh, wow.
That would have been interesting.
I want a Pressman Jellicoe ship. where they fight every week over who's the captain.
they keep ending up in 10 forward having like a shifting of ceremonies.
Yes.
Or a shifting of command in that ceremony.
Yes.
Which, Jimmy, you're a big fan of the evening gowns that they're all wearing.
Yeah, that was very nice. Their version of the tux. yeah, like when you first see it, I was just like, how far is it, like a miniskirt they're wearing? Like, where does it finish? But
yeah, anyway. So it was a miniskirt.
I just wanted to, like, make a point about Riker.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy seems so concerned about Picard and Jellicoe going to save, like, you know, going to save him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets dismissed. And then we see him, like, all concerned in his pajamas reading a good book. And I was just like, what? That doesn't make sense. Like, are you not sad that your captain could be dead and he's just reading a good book in his pajamas getting ready for bed?
No, like, you didn't see the title of the book, though, but it said How to Write a Eulogy. So he did care.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually, that never occurred to me. He was taking it remarkably well.
Yes!
And really, all he wanted to do at that point was stick it to Jellicoe.
Yes.
Which, again, that's his triumph. You know, Picard has his Four Lights triumph over Madred. I mean, Riker's is basically, you know, Jellicoe, you know, tells Riker why he's not a good first officer. And Riker just kind of smiles and then tears into Jellicoe. And you can see it bothers Jellicoe.
Oh, yeah. It gets under his skin.
Yes.
Very similar to how Picard is able to get under Gul Madred's skin.
Yes, and he gets the upper hand by saying, you know, well, then ask me.
You know,
to fly that shuttle into the mission. I mean, ultimately, he's the one who had Jellicoe eating out of his hand.
Jimmy, I'm curious. So, Cam, you and I, we did a podcast a few months back. We were discussing whether the Cardassians are the best aliens featured in Star Trek.
Oh, man, that was almost a year ago.
Was it really? Wow.
That was like last August.
Time flies, man.
It does.
Jimmy, I'm curious. Just what are your thoughts about the Cardassians here? This is just like a two-parter that you saw, but I mean, do they stand out to you as more intriguing than just the average alien, or I don't know, were they developed enough for you? I'm just curious about what your thoughts are on the Cardassians, that they got a whole lot more screen time when we get around to Deep Space Nine, which I don't think you're as familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, they're good. Like, I enjoyed them. They seem really interesting.
You get some backstory on them about how there used to be a very spiritual people.
Yeah.
And, you know, the military kind of took over in the face of war and kind of changed their society.
Yeah, exactly. They're not just kind of, they don't just show up. And then, yeah, it's nice that you get a bit of backstory and, like, into their history. And you're like, oh, I'm interested in knowing, like, what actually happened to these people.
Yeah.
That made them turn this way. So, yeah, they are good. Like, do you think they'll be shown in any future films? Like,
They were referenced to in Star Trek Into Darkness. I don't think they'll make an appearance in Star Trek Beyond. I just think there's so much potential for them. I would kind of be surprised if they're not featured somehow in the Star Trek 2017 series.
Yeah.
I mean, Cam, they'd be, like, Brian Fuller would be giving up, like, a ripe opportunity for some pretty amazing characters if the Cardassians are not really featured in that series.
I've long maintained that we need a Cardassian in the bridge in 2017.
I agree.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Here's a quote that I want to bring up, and because I just asked you a little bit about kind of how your views are of our Cardassians, and I brought up the fact that they used to be very spiritual people. I've talked a little bit about the spiritual battle going on between Picard and Madred. Here's probably my favorite quote of this entire episode, and it's not about whether there's four or five lights. It's after Picard encounters Madred's daughter, who's witnessing, you know, Picard being tortured by the daughter's father. He says to Madred, her belly may be full, but her spirit will be empty.
Right.
And I think that's just a very fascinating thing, because this is a spiritual battle going on. And I think ultimately, Picard prevails, but as he says to Troi, and this is why I really do appreciate this episode, at the very end, he says, I had the choice to either accept comfort if I could only agree that there were five lights. Mm-hmm. He says he was going to do it.
Yeah.
But at the last moment, he was pulled away by the guards. He was willing to give it all up. And I think that... So who ultimately wins here?
Well, it's about the victory, though, that Madred... that they both share. So to Madred, he never broke Picard.
Yeah.
Picard may have been was going to do it, but it doesn't matter, because ultimately Madred did not get the victory.
Here's the thing. Give it 30 more seconds.
For sure, yeah.
And here's the thing. Madred never knew that he could have had that victory.
But,
so
a battle can be won in seconds.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so it's kind of fascinating. Yeah, Picard ultimately wins, mm-hmm. but it comes very, very close. About as close to a draw as you can get, or as close to a victory for Madred as you could get as well. I find that fascinating. When I talk about like a spiritual battle, I'm not talking about, you know, kind of supernatural or mm-hmm. religious, so to speak, but just kind of more of that human spirits, you know?
Speaking of human, actually, I really was interested to see an episode where we get to see the humans demonized to a degree that is really uncomfortable. It's not just like, oh, you know, evil humans, we must stop them. It's like the way that Madred sort of refers to Picard only as human, that he speaks, you know, to his daughter about basically how humans are like almost like animals.
Yeah. Like they don't love their children the way that Cardassians do.
Yeah, like they are demonized in the way that I feel like the Klingons have been in the past, right. In older Trek. But probably worse, so more uncomfortably. And I think that's really important to have in Star Trek, where not all these these races are going to be meeting as sort of worthy adversaries.
Well, it's kind of...
And it speaks to the Cardassians, who are pretty awful a lot of the time.
But to me, it's bringing up parallels, you know, like to kind of World War II propaganda. Yeah. You just hear, oh, you know, the Japanese, you know, were subhuman. Mm-hmm. That sort of stuff was going on.
Well, it's easier to destroy an enemy if you think they're, you know, demons, basically.
Yeah, and that's why, again, you mentioned it, Madred would only refer to Picard as human. Mm-hmm. Picard loved to point out at a certain point, you just called me Picard.
Yeah.
Picard, and that really got under Madred's skin. Like, he started using a zapper on him.
Right, yeah, he says you're weak and helpless. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, amazing, like, such a layered antagonist. Picard keeps calling him out on, oh, you're just like this petty little child, you know?
Well, I wrote in my notes, actually, that I think of Gal Madred a little bit as a victim of abuse.
Sure.
He is, and, you know, cycles of abuse repeat. And we see him talk about, you know, as like a young Cardassian living in poverty, being basically beaten up for eggs. And essentially that weak child is still there, and Picard is calling him out on it. But ultimately, he is now putting forth the abuse that was heaped upon him as a child.
Well, I'm also curious, again, that's exactly what he's doing, mm-hmm. but even Golamek's reaction at the very end of the episode when he sees what Madred's done to Picard, mm-hmm. honestly, I don't think it takes the Cardassians by that much surprise, but where do you think, you know, Madred's career is after this? Do you think, he's given props, or do you think he's kind of like, I don't know, like... banished to being a desk jockey or something like that? Or do you think it's somewhere in between?
Well, how prominent do you think Madred really is with the Cardassians? I wonder if he's just kind of a guy who kind of does things.
He sits in an office.
He does sit in an office.
And he holds the equivalent rank of a captain.
Yeah.
You know?
I would be curious, though, if they just kind of have him just deal with prisoners all day and just mm-hmm. kind of, like, shuffle him away and don't really want to acknowledge his presence.
He's kind of like the warden at a county jail.
Yeah.
You know, who gets really into his job a little bit too much.
I mean, he's basically gone insane.
Do you think it's like... because that guy came in and he seemed pretty shocked at what how Picard looked.
Yeah.
Like, do you think this guy has, like, gone off the rails in terms of, like, how they treat people? Or, like,
I think he had a lot of autonomy in his position. The other thing is, remember, Golomek showed Riker and Jellicoe the footage of Picard under the influence of that drug.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can assume that's all Golomek was privy to.
Yeah.
But I think he was going off the rails. I think, you know, he was kind of losing it. Like, he was on an utter power trip, you know. And,
well, when he captures Picard in the first place, he says, you know, you will be a challenge. And he knows all about Picard.
Yeah.
He's kind of like the Joker in the sense that, like, he's waiting for a Batman. He's waiting for his sort of polar opposite that he can sort of engage in this weirdo battle with. And, I mean, the fact that he knows so much about Picard and is like, you are going to be basically my greatest challenge. This guy is not right in the head. And I feel like the second Picard walked into his office, like, that was going to be possibly his undoing.
Yeah, but it is tough because I do wonder if we risk taking away a lot of what makes Mandred great. Because I do think he's perhaps, like, one of the most layered antagonists we've ever seen in Star Trek, though. And by reducing him to, oh, he's just a sociopath.
Well, I'm not saying he's just a sociopath, but I feel like he saw this as this was going to be his greatest triumph.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was.
Well, he's even torturing him stuff like, oh yeah, you can leave, but we're going to just torture your doctor.
Yeah, or it was nice. Like, I liked his lies, like, in a sense. And I was just like, oh, they're on the ship. They're safe. Like,
he was telling them the Enterprise is burning at this very moment.
I love that, too, because he knows that Picard's going to be taken out any minute.
Any minute, yeah.
He's like, this is all I got. I got these last few minutes. He's down to the clock.
Well, that's the whole spiritual battle. He's trying to just, like, crush him in those final few seconds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even going towards the zapper at that point. Mm-hmm. He, you know, it's...
Is anyone else counting the lights? I was. I was like,
how many did you see?
I was like,
did you count?
There is four. Like, what's going on?
By the end, you saw five, didn't you?
Well, I mean, guys, we've talked a lot about, like, what works here. I think there's way more stuff that works and doesn't work. But
there is one thing I want to talk about that really works.
Okay.
We've talked about other two-parters, how the crew, a lot of the crew gets kind of shuffled off to the side or whatever.
Yeah.
Every crew member doesn't just get something to do. They get something to do that is genuinely interesting.
You know what?
Troy is doing her job.
Yes.
Crusher is seducing a Ferengi, taking part in the mission. You know, she's, like, speaking up against Jellicoe. Geordi
actually has stuff to do in a two-parter, which is very rare.
Worf's got a lot to do. The only one I think who maybe has a little less to do is Data. But he gets sort of more of the spotlight as being the new first officer.
Yeah.
And I love the visual language of when he's promoted. There is no exposition saying, I'm promoting Data to first officer. It's just cut to him wearing the red uniform. It's never acknowledged.
You got a chuckle out of that, I heard.
I loved it. It was great. Yeah. Because so often Star Trek falls back on exposition and explaining things. And in that moment, they're like, no, people will get it. Just, you know, have some trust in the viewer to pick up on the visual language of it.
Yeah. So maybe we can transition to maybe some of the stuff that doesn't work so well. There's not too much for me to tackle, and a lot of it is maybe kind of on the surface. I don't know, why was, you know, Dr. Crusher on this mission? Is because of her familiarity with metagenic weapons, or I don't know.
Let's back up here. Let's not talk about Crusher. Let's talk about pretty much the trio, with maybe the exception of Worf.
I can understand why Worf was on this. Picard, he happened to be the commander of a ship that, like, researched these rays.
He's a little old to be going on missions like this.
Yeah.
Frankly, I would expect Starfleet to send some people from, like, Section 31 or something like that. Like, or just younger talent.
Is it not, like, lead from the front?
Yeah.
That kind of thing? Like, captain, like,
well,
don't do anything. Don't do anything, like...
Captains are not supposed to go on away missions, essentially.
Should Riker have been on this mission?
Should have been Riker. He could have been the pilot, as we found out later on in the episode with their button pushing that they're so good at.
He's the best button pusher in the galaxy.
Yeah.
Here's
the thing. The plan here was designed to get Picard in the position that he was in.
Yes.
You know, and that's it's pretty transparent.
Their workouts were pretty sad looking. The three of them, like, we gotta cut some, you know, seconds off our running time while they do a light jog offset.
I was like, okay. Well, I love how sweaty Picard appeared in his quarters after doing, like, the light jog. Yeah. You often see kind of those elderly groups walking around the malls on Sundays. It just kind of, like, kind of felt a little bit like that. Although, I say this, Patrick Stewart, Seaman the Buff, he looks quite buff. I may say myself.
Yeah, so one of my big things was noticing that I'm not a big fan of the
Patrick Stewart in the buff. I don't know, I'm a big fan. Like,
well, I like the vulnerability of that moment. I mean, because it definitely makes your jaw drop, because that's not something you see in Star Trek. He's the only captain you're seeing strung up naked.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But, one of the things I didn't like actually kind of ties into what you were saying, actually, is just basically...
Well, maybe you need to see Scott Bakula in Behind the Candelabra, Cam.
I've seen it.
Okay.
Yes.
There you go.
Non-canon.
No idea what you're talking about.
Non-canon.
That was, Scott Bakula is friends with Liberace in the HBO film directed by Steven Soderbergh, talking about Liberace's lover. Played by one Matt Damon.
Very good movie.
Yeah.
Very good.
Well, I thought it was a very well-made movie. I don't know.
I liked it a lot.
I wasn't super engaged by the story, though. I love the performances and the directing.
Cam's thinking, carry on, but I'm cutting this out as soon as I get home.
That is not what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, like, we need to have, like, our own Liberace podcast. We need to start the Candelabra cast.
Wait, I've been running one for about 3 years now. I can't believe I've never asked you to come on.
But I want to talk about, frankly, that entire sequence. Like, I feel like all of the stuff in the, what I call the Disneyland Matterhorn cave, was a little clunky. Like, it's obviously there to take up some time in part one and to show that Picard is kind of doing something, because ultimately I didn't think their mission was that interesting to watch.
No.
I mean, you have the styrofoam rocks.
Yeah.
And you have them in, like, their medieval knitted stealth wear. Well, it's a little clunky.
I wrote, you know, Worf's ninja suit.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. Part one was written by Ron Moore, the teleplay. Story credit goes to a freelancer, I believe, Frank Marco?
Mm-hmm.
Never a last name I've heard of, but, you know... So my sense is that this is a freelancer who sold a script that was pretty much the spine of part two. They pretty much just wanted to elongate part one. They introduced Jellicoe, because I really don't imagine Jellicoe was as prominent in, like, the original script as maybe they made it out to be in this two-parter.
I mean, you always want to expand the role if you're going to get Ronnie Cox in your cast, because he's great.
Yeah, but it's obvious. I mean, I think part two was essentially the script that the freelancer sent in. They go and expand that for part one as well.
So the freelancer writes the good script, and then the TV guys...
You know, like... I honestly, you hear a lot of the commentaries, and I think a lot of these freelance scripts, they have maybe a good idea at the core.
Oh, okay.
They require a lot of rewriting. I really doubt that part two, like, all the dialogue, the back and forth, the spiritual battle between Madrid and Picard was actually coming from this freelancer.
Tough to say, he got sole credit.
Yeah, I think that's more of a courtesy thing. It's very common for people to have their scripts completely rewritten and still credited to
them.
Very true. I'm very skeptical of the fact that this freelancer had more than, I would say, 30% of his original scripts end up on the screen. I'd be very skeptical if it was even, like, 15%. But
right.
I don't know, that's something that we'll never even know.
Right.
And unless he writes into the show, if you could, that'd be great, just to clear this up.
I would appreciate that. But, okay, so guys, one of the questions we always try to answer, you know, when we're going through these two-parters is whether it justifies itself as a two-part episode. We've had issues with a lot of the other previous ones.
I think all of them, pretty much.
Well, you know, Time's Arrow, I think we had realized that was the most consistent two-part episode. Jamie, this is when the crew goes back to a 19th century San Francisco to an epidemic that was going on. We actually thought it was, like, a good, fun, lighthearted episode. It was far and away the most consistent two-parter up until that point. I think this one is even more consistent. And here's the thing. It's kind of divided as an obvious two-parter. We've got, you know, Jellicoe coming in, kind of shaking up the crew in part one. And then part two is really that big battle between Madred and Picard. So I think this is such a great... This totally justifies itself as a two-part episode.
Yeah, I agree. Like, the ideas in the episodes are too big to, like, squeeze it into 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you definitely need... you know, an hour and a half to cover it.
But I did like the ideas that were presented to us in the Menagerie. Why is this stronger for you than, you know, what we, you know, were witness to in the Menagerie, when the central kind of question they're asking is it better to live a happy lie or to face reality, you know, and live kind of this poor life that's real, essentially?
Yeah, I mean...
I found it an interesting question, but...
I enjoyed parts of the Menagerie. The parts that weren't...
The end credits.
Yeah, parts of it good. Like, it, but that did really feel like they were just kind of trying to stretch it out to two parts.
Sure.
Whereas this one, I think, like you said, it justifies it. Like, mm-hmm. yeah, there's a lot of exposition in part one, and in part one, yeah, I kind of only was interested in the Jellicoe. Him being introduced his relationship with the crew members. But, like, the mission, like Cam said, I wasn't that excited about. But, yeah, like, I still think it justifies itself.
Cam?
Yeah, this is one of the few where I feel like, usually when we watch these two-parters, it feels often like two episodes welded together.
Sure.
You know, and this one definitely has, I would say, the trademarks of TNG's two-parters, where it starts as one character's sort of story and segs into a different character's story in the second part.
Mm-hmm.
Because, obviously, the first part is not Picard's story. It's more about Riker and the crew dealing with Jellicoe.
I like how, like, a lot of these two-parters, it's dealing with, like, Riker's career.
Yeah.
It's very fascinating.
Yeah. No, I completely think this works, though, because I think that while there is a difference in the stories being told from one to two, I think that there is so much consistency. Like, we've seen, you know, when we talked about unification, the two parts were Cliff Bull and Les Landau directed the two different parts. And they felt so tonally different.
Yes.
That it was really awkward. Whereas this time, you know...
They couldn't get the eye lines right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this time we had Robert Shearer doing part one and Les Landau doing part two. They felt like a whole to me. Like, there was never a part where they felt like a clunky, like, well, this is an awkward two-parter. This, to me, feels fairly seamless. More seamless than Best of Both Worlds. And I think it's the most compelling of the two-parters. So it's interesting to me just how effective it is, because I just wonder, like, why did they have so much trouble doing this?
Well, you and I, we criticized Les Landau's direction for Unification Part 2 a lot. But I think he was essentially like...
I think he was Part 1 of Unification.
I thought he directed the first episode that was produced, which was actually Part 2.
Of course,
because it was Leonard Nimoy's scheduling or something. Yeah. Here's the thing. I think he was essentially like Director 1B. I think David Carson was 1A on the set of Next Gen. I don't know, what do you think of Star Trek Generations directed by Les Landau as opposed to David Carson? Because I really think the direction of Part 2 of Chain of Command was exceptional. And I think he really made up for whatever we criticized him for in Part 2 of Unification.
So you're asking, what do I think of Les Landau directing Star Trek Generations?
Could he have salvaged the last hour of that film?
In the words of Harrison Ford to George Lucas... You can write this shit, George, but you can't say it.
Okay. That movie was still just, like, hammered by the script problems?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. No, I mean...
Do you think he would have given us a rock scene where Picard's stuck in the middle of the rock like we got from David Carson? Do you think he at least could have directed that a little better?
I think anyone could have directed that better.
It was so awkward.
It was awful.
Okay.
We've never seen anything that awkward in Les Landau's directing career.
I don't know. That Admiral...
Oh, man.
I don't know, that was pretty weird.
Start a unification.
Oh, wait, no. Was that Les Landau, or is that...
It was Les Landau, yeah.
So, did he direct part one of...
Yeah, it was Cliff Bull did part two.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so confused, but okay, yeah. I take it back. Les Landau directed part one.
Yeah.
We had major issues with his directing in that episode.
There was a couple small notes I wanted to mention about this episode that I really just enjoyed or noted. It's not cam fiction. I saw Tyler start to tense up.
Yeah.
I really liked that Captain Jellicoe got to do a captain's log.
Yeah, oh, I love that. You know, you're kind of getting the idea that, you know, the perspective of the show is shifting.
And it feels weird. Like, it doesn't feel right, and I like that.
Do you really think any viewer actually thought that he was going to be the new lead character of this series? But it, just doing a captain's log, it really throws people off.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
So I really like that. Another moment I actually liked, a Troy moment that I doubt would ever get called out, but when Crusher is, you know, just been training for her mission, she's, like, exhausted, and she looks kind of, you know, she's sore. She's, like, you know, holding her arm or something like that. And she says to Troy, like, I can't tell you what's going on or whatever. And just, like, the look on Troy's face of Troy just, like, reading what Beverly is sending, essentially.
Yeah.
And showing so much concern. Like, that is a great performance moment from Marina Sirtis as, you know, an empath that I really liked. And it's such an unflashy moment, but it's such a great character moment.
Well, just even like that moment where she was stunned when Jellicoe didn't really care about her concerns about the crew. Like, I thought this is subtly like a great Marina Sirtis showcase as well. Mm-hmm. We finally get to see her again after like a 6-year gap in like a professional Starfleet uniform. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of, you know, her transformation into a more serious character. At least I think the writers were taking her more seriously as well.
For sure. And I was just curious from you guys, what did you think of Jellicoe's ultimate plan of, like, mining the Cardassian fleet?
It worked, did it not?
Yeah?
He got those magnetic mines to stick to their bellies, and he's able to convince them to get Picard back. I don't know, were you a little bit more...
Do you think Picard would ever do that?
No. I don't know, Jamie, what do you think? Do you think this is a Picard plan that he'd be willing to do, or is it... the master strategist, military strategist known as Jellicoe, who's only capable of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons why I like Jellicoe, that he was taking action mm-hmm. in some respects. Like in, so yeah, no, I thought it was a good plan, and it obviously worked. So,
do you think there was another solution to the problem? Or do you think, like, a Jellicoe is necessary to do this?
Well, hey, let's say if Picard's off the ship, hey, you know, if Worf was in command, I kind of see Worf coming up with something.
What if Picard is in charge, though? What if, say, they aren't sending Picard away on a mission? Could Picard have dealt with this situation on his own?
Well, here's the difference between Jellicoe and Picard, though. Jellicoe's such a micromanager. I think mm-hmm. Picard's willing to listen to more people
mm-hmm.
in under his command, more than senior officers. Maybe they could have, Geordi and Worf could have devised something like this. You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. What do you guys think about the fact that Starfleet essentially sends Worf, Beverly, and Picard on a suicide mission, which all three of those officers, they're aware that there's a huge chance they're not coming back?
Yeah.
Is it worth sending three of these officers on a suicide mission, essentially?
It seems like a problematic decision to me.
Yes.
but, I mean, I guess then you have to go back to, say, original series and be like, why are they sending Kirk, Spock, and McCoy away on missions?
Eh.
You know, those three, you know, Trelane decides to kill those three, and that Enterprise is in trouble. It's a conceit of the series that they always have to send the most interesting characters away on the mission or whatever.
Yeah.
Or the leading characters. And that doesn't really make sense with Starfleet's sort of quasi-military setup.
At least then, they're just sending them on missions that they want them to succeed at.
There's some dangerous missions, though, they're sending them.
There's some dangerous missions, but this, was essentially a suicide mission.
Yes.
It even comes to the point Picard's literally nearly murdered.
Yeah.
Executed.
Yeah.
You know?
No thanks to Jellicoe. And he, like, Picard comes in to the bridge, and they just have a nice handshake. Like no hard feelings.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of... Yeah, that kind of bothered me.
It's interesting to me that, like, Picard is so haunted by the Borg going forward, but he didn't seem that haunted by Cardassians.
Well, this seems like far more... Well, the possibility of it being far more traumatizing as well.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know how much of the Borg experience he would really remember. It's tough to say, but
yeah.
I feel like the Cardassian one, that would be tough to... I feel like he'd be in therapy for quite a long time.
I think with the Borg stuff... I think he feels much more complicit with what happened to, I mean, the thousands of people that died in War 359 versus being captured and tortured by an individual here.
Is Picard the most tortured captain?
I think, I'll give it to Sisko.
You think Sisko still?
Now, do you mean literally tortured? I'm thinking about, like, maybe spiritually tortured.
Who's the biggest mess at the end of... Like, when their career is wrapped up, who's the one that's the biggest mess of a human being?
I think Sisko. Like, you think Sisko? He's dealing with a deceased wife at the beginning, raising a kid. He's got a lot of big spiritual issues to overcome. By the end of the series, I don't know, maybe he is more at peace because he kind of fulfills his role as the emissary. So who knows? Maybe he is more at ease with his role in the universe by the end of it.
I feel like Sisko is actually better off because Sisko has a far better support structure.
Yeah.
Picard, I mean...
He's got a family.
Yeah.
I mean, Picard seemed to brush it off pretty quickly. By the time the end of the episode came, he'd written a report after being tortured.
That's all it takes.
And then he was happy to sit down and have counseling.
But I do appreciate the fact that at the end of it, he's sitting down and he's having counseling, you know?
You know that had this episode been made in modern television, he would have been dealing with PTSD through the rest of the season.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Probably into the next season, too. So, yeah, the other thing that just popped into my head was, I like that whenever they hire Cardassian actors, they're these very thin men. And I've now become convinced I really, at some point in the future, want to see Tom Hiddleston play a Cardassian. I think he would be fantastic.
I think Doug Petrie would be a great Cardassian, too. I'd be down for that. Hey, maybe we'll get Tom Hiddleston for... Star Trek 4.
Yeah, you know, that would be pretty great, I think. Okay. He's got the chops for it.
I'm down for that.
Okay, so I think on that note, we'll say this assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. Let us know what you think of Chain of Command. Are you a big fan? Do you think it's the most consistent two-parter? Is it the best two-parter? Or is it the worst? Shock us. I would love to hear an email that made an argument as to why it's the worst.
Guys, do you like Jellicoe, or do you think he's a real jerk? I don't know. Would you want to serve under Jellicoe versus, say, Admiral Pressman?
You can also leave a review for us on our iTunes page. Reviews help us get better ratings, better placement on the Star Trek podcast page, and they will in turn give us power to take over the galaxy and essentially rule you all. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Victory of the Four Lights, Smith.
That's quite the stretch, but okay.
Thank you.
You can find me at Reporton. That's REPORTON, and is in Nicheyev. Jamie, what's your Instagram?
I will not be giving that out. And
do you want to give out your home address?
I'm not on Twitter, so you won't be finding me anywhere.
Guys, contact me, and I'll forward on all your Facebook friend requests to Jamie.
Yeah. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.